Hello, this is Terrence McNally. I was a virtual attendee at an inspiring and humbling memorial last week for the late Edgar Kahn on what would have been his 88th birthday. Edgar's unique contributions to society came through in the tributes of many former partners and allies, including Ralph Nader and Jamie Raskin. Kahn, an unsung hero of 20th century America, authored articles and books that intentionally led to national policy, including the War on Poverty in 1964, which led to the establishment of legal aid, Hunger USA in 1968, Our Brother's Keeper, The Indian and White America, 1969, Time Dollars, 1992, and No More Throwaway People in the year 2000. He and his wife, the late Jean Camper, co-founded Antioch School of Law, now the District of Columbia Law School. Here's my 2012 conversation with Edgar Kahn and Thomas Frank, influential author of What's the Matter with Kansas, One Market Under God, and Pity the Billionaire. Terrence McNally, and welcome again to Free Forum. Since I suspect many of you might have been traveling or not quite settled into your normal routine last Sunday, New Year's Day, I feel that this is in some ways the first show of 2012. And so I want to have a conversation about where we are as a society as we embark on the next year. And I've invited two guests who I think have a great deal to offer to such a conversation. Thomas Frank, who now writes the monthly column in the front of Harper's Magazine, a role so long and ably filled by Lewis Lapham, is the author of important books on our culture and politics, perhaps most notably What's the Matter with Kansas. His newest book, just out, is Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Times Swindle, and the Unlikely Comeback of the Right. In it, Frank examines how the crash that has hurt so many millions of Americans has delivered wildly perverse political results. He gives us a diagnosis of the cultural malady that has transformed collapse into profit, reconceived the founding fathers as heroes from an Ayn Rand novel, and enlisted the powerless in a fan club for the prosperous. My other guest, Edgar Kahn, was a social entrepreneur before the term was invented. And if I can invent another, I would call him a social justice entrepreneur. In the 1970s, he and his wife co-founded the Legal Services Program to deliver legal services to those who otherwise couldn't afford them. And they co-founded Antioch School of Law, where students learned by providing just such services. Two decades later, Kahn created Time Dollars, a system to bank and exchange work, or talent, rather than currency. Now, I'm going to ask each about their respective works and passions, but I also want to engage them in a larger conversation at some point here, in which we take a fairly big picture perspective. While I assume we might talk about global economics, international conflicts, the emphasis will be on the United States. And while I assume we will talk about the fall election, I want us to look at things more broadly. Where are we as a society? What's working? Why is it working? What are their fears and hopes for the years ahead? That sort of thing. Let me mention just a couple of more biographical points about each of them before I bring them in. Thomas Frank is a former opinion columnist for the Wall Street Journal. He was the founding editor of The Baffler, and among his other books are The Conquest of Cool, that was the subject of our first interview back in 1997, and One Market Under God. Edgar Kahn teaches law and justice and directs the community service program at the University of the District of Columbia School of Law. And he's the author of several books, including Hunger USA, No More Throwaway People, and Time Dollars. Welcome to Pacifica and Free Forum, Thomas Frank.
Hey, how are you today?
I'm good, Tom. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
And Edgar Kahn.
Good to be with you again.
Okay. Now, if you two have never met, allow me to introduce you. Because you both live within a few miles of each other. And what, as I was thinking about pairing the two of you in this conversation, it occurred to me that, Tom, you've basically, as I pointed out, Conquest of Cool was the first book that I interviewed you on, and that had a little to say about politics, but was much more about culture.
That's right.
over the years, it seems your beat has become more and more political, but it seems to me what singles you out in a way is that you still come from that that baffler conquest of cool cultural perspective.
That's absolutely correct. I think I would be interested in the present political moment, and write about it in the way that I do, even if I wasn't, interested in politics, even if I wasn't a liberal and wasn't, worried about the direction that the country was going in, because it's so culturally perverse.
Exactly. Now, the other thing that I realized, again, juxtaposing the two of you, is that, Edgar, you actually engaged in government when idealistic big government was a cultural norm and was a great hope in American society.
Well, I haven't given up on government. I think it's our government. I don't think it's anybody else's, and I think it's about time we began to appreciate the ways in which it can be a catalyst, maybe some new ways, maybe a paradigm shift, but I think the functions of government are as critical as ever.
Well, we'll talk about your current ideas and innovations at some point during the hour, but what I wanted to do at the very start here is actually when I was thinking as I was driving over here, the first election I really paid attention, first presidential election I really paid attention to was 1960. I was 12, and that was Kennedy-Nixon. It would have been the end of Roosevelt, the first Dewey Truman election. Am I correct?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so what I wanted, just as a sense, we will talk about the current state, but you were an assistant to Sergeant Shriver. You worked in setting up legal services. You worked with the Justice Department under Robert Kennedy. Just something about that perspective of being a part of government when everyone assumed that it served the people.
Well, don't forget Kennedy's inaugural, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. And I came into government at a time when working in government shifted from being, frankly, low prestige to being the exciting and hot place to go, in part because of the effect of the civil rights movement, in part because there was an era when I think people wanted change and we had to respond to change. And I think government played, particularly the federal government at that point, in dealing with segregation was at a key point, in a key intervener in a shift to begin dealing with equality and fundamental aspirations for equal rights.
Yeah, exactly. Let me tell people, by the way, I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Thomas Frank and Edgar Kahn about where we are as we begin 2012. Frank is a monthly columnist for Harper's and the author of several books, including What's the Matter with Kansas? His newest is Pity the Billionaire. And you can learn more about Tom's work at tcfrank, one word, tcfrank.com. Kahn has for decades been a social justice entrepreneur, co-founding Legal Services in the 70s and creating Time Dollars. You can learn more about his work at TimeBanks, one word, TimeBanks, timebanks.org. You can visit me, Terrence McNally, at terrencemcnally.net. That's Terrence McNally, one word, TerrenceMcNally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website, and you can learn more about the show, guests, podcast, transcripts. You can sign up on my site or at iTunes to have the podcast delivered to you weekly. You can get the podcast either at my site or at iTunes. And you can sign up at my site or email me at T-E-McNally, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y, at mac.com to get a weekly announcement by email in which I tell you what we're going to talk about and some background on the issues. Now that I've sort of set up this kind of relationship between the two of you, let me go a little bit to Tom. A lot of the people associate you with What's the Matter with Kansas. That's kind of the first thing. That book really came out of your personal experience. So where Edgar has just talked about his personal experience, a little about yours that led you to What's the Matter with Kansas?
Well, I guess what you're getting at is that I was growing up in the 70s, and this was one of the the great eras of conservatism, and I was pretty conservative as a young person, and Kansas was a fairly conservative place, and so I reflect a lot on my own my youthful conservatism, which I think I've since grown out of in most ways. But it's funny because you were talking about, the 1948 election and sort of the great heyday of the liberal state. And that's just something that my generation has never known.
That's right. That's exactly what I was pointing to, was that while as a young idealistic and practical person, Edgar was toiling in this, it was something that was almost gone by the time your generation was really looking at
things. Oh, yeah. It was my generation was it wasn't a generational thing. It was just in the air at the time, this sort of extreme cynicism about the state and about big government. And it's continued, and it worsens it seems to worsen every year, to the point where today you have this, prairie fire revolt against government all over the country, this sort of right-wing populist revolt that's sweeping the land, and that's what Pity the Billionaire is about in a kind of sarcastic way.
Yeah, very much so. And one piece in that is that when this – I'm going to just give you my own personal take, and then I have another question for you, Tom, which is that when I speak to people from other countries, one of the things they marvel at in this country is that one of the major political parties, and thus, some huge amount, say 30%, 40% of the political energy in this country is actually opposed to public service. In most other countries where you have the Tories and Labour in England and so on, they still kind of believe in the work of government. It's just, how do we do it? But here you actually have an enormous amount of political energy that goes to destroy what it is they're running for office for, to defund, to when they're in office, it's to actively defund it and make it not work.
Right.
And when they're out of office,
it's
to sabotage it. And so that the people, the spectators of this sport, if you will, begin to believe less and less in government when you've got this huge energy attempting to sabotage it and destroy it is not a surprise.
Well,
I wanted to talk, Tom.
It creates a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Exactly. I wanted to talk about one thing with you, Tom, before we get into the present again, which is an interview that you did with Bill Moyers, kind of looking back at the first year of Obama's office.
Okay.
Right? And first of all, let me just tell people, the good news is that Bill Moyers will be back on the air this month. After 20 months, his latest retirement lasted 20 months. He's going to be back again. He's not going to be carried by PBS nationally this time around. It's American Public Television, another distributor of public programming. So you're going to have to check BillMoyers.com to figure out when and where he's going to be on wherever you are. That's the good news. The bad news is that I had invited him to be part of this conversation, and because of the show's about to start, he declined. But what struck me in that interview, Tom Frank, and I've referred to it many times since on the air and elsewhere, is in it you laid out, this is a year after Obama takes office, you laid out the approach to both the narrative, I think, and to the policy that you felt Obama and the Democrats could have and should have taken. It was powerful. It made a ton of sense. But essentially, you said he should have told Americans a very clear story of Wall Street, money, and politics to explain how things had gotten so bad and what it was going to take to fix them. And near the end of this, just devastating look back at the Bush administration and the waste that they'd left Obama when he took office, near the end, Bill Moyers asked you, why is it you thought that Obama and the Democrats hadn't done that? And your answer, I may be paraphrasing, was, I suspect they didn't want to offend their funders. And I have referred to that moment many times since. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, you know, Barack Obama is a very intelligent man. I've met him. You know, his advisors are intelligent people. It seems unlikely that they don't know what has happened, you know, how the government has been, you know, defunded. And you know, look, we're living in a time of these sort of epic regulatory failures. First, you've got the, you know, the financial and banking regulators totally, well, I mean, the polite word is asleep at the switch. You know, that's the nice way to put it. But you know, they're asleep at the switch because that's what they were hired to be. They hired these, you know, extremely sleepy guys. You know, that was on purpose, you know, and they defunded or underfunded the Securities and Exchange Commission. And then there's, you know, then there's the name was the Minerals Management Service. It was supposed to oversee offshore drilling. Remember the BP disaster? And then there's the, you know, the people that are supposed to oversee coal mining in this country. And those men who died in that coal mine in West Virginia, and they had, you know, the company had just fooled the regulators in all these different ways. And, you know, you've just got one example of this after another. Now, don't tell me that Barack Obama, this very intelligent man, can't figure out how these things are connected. He just won't talk about it. They won't mention it. They won't discuss it. And meanwhile, the public's faith in government is just, it's, you know, at one of these sort of all-time lows. I mean, nobody thinks government can do the right thing after this series of disasters. The only real big intervention that they made into the economy after the after the financial crisis was to bail out the big banks, you know, to ride to the rescue of the culprits, and while everybody else sort of lost their shirt. I mean, yes, they did a big stimulus package in 2009, but that was much less concerted effort than when they rescued the banks. And so people are extremely cynical about government, and I think in some ways rightfully so. And you know, this is the attitude that is destroying liberalism in this country, destroying the possibility for a liberal state or liberal idealism. And why can't our president address it? Why can't he deal with this? Why can't he take it on, you know, head first? Go right into it.
And as people have pointed out, FDR did a number of things, and I won't go into all of them, but one of them was he actually did see the Depression and his election as a teachable moment, and he did develop a story that he shared in his fireside chats on the one hand, and then he told progressives, make me do the things you want me to do on the other, and that combination, it seemed to me, was what allowed the New Deal to happen.
But if you go back and look at his very first inaugural address, I mean, it was a frightening moment. The banks of the country were all closed. I mean, there at that moment when he was inaugurated, I mean, there essentially was no U.S. economy. If those banks didn't reopen, we were done for. And he, in his speech, you know, talked about the sort of the high priests in the economic temple, you know, the money changers abandoning their positions of authority and, you know, the complete discrediting of this old orthodoxy. You know, it was very, very powerful stuff. He didn't try to mollify them. He talked about what had gone wrong. He confronted it very, very directly. You know, there's so many things that they did in that era that was just, you know, they're awe-inspiring, things that our politicians can't seem to even get close to nowadays. And, well, I mean, they had their chance. You know, Obama had his chance in 2009. He was, you know, that great moment when he was, you know, those gigantic crowds that were following him around the country at both houses of Congress. And now it's, you know, a desperate battle to keep the Tea Party movement from taking over the government at the end of this year.
Yeah.
Edgar, chime
in, please.
I think when Obama came in, there were two things going on. One was I think he desperately wanted to be the president of the entire nation, that here he was the first African-American president, And he wanted to be, in some sense, almost too beloved by everybody. And it was that effort to try and breach and bridge, breach the gap and bridge to the other side, and that longing to unify that I think weakened any resolve to do the kinds of courageous things that he should have done or could have done. I think the other piece is, in fact, money and the fact that what Lawrence Lessig's book, Republic Lost, indicates is that if less than 5% of, less than 1% of the money that elects Congress comes from, 100% of the money that comes that is responsible for electing Congress people comes from such a small portion of the population, you've got to be very careful, and your funders, your congressmen are dependent on that money, and that's part of the corruption and the sale of democracy that's taking place.
Yeah, one of my metaphors, if you will, is that now that, I place a lot of it to the emergence, if we're looking at that historical perspective where we talked about Truman, Kennedy, etc., leading up to the present. Many people look at the Kennedy-Nixon election as a key turning point because the televised debates. I believe that the televised debates have had less impact than the televised political ads. That once it became you had to raise money for television ads, you then threw out any way that you felt you could raise that money from individual constituents, and the thing shifted so that both sides now are funded by the same, their primary funders are the same. One side absolutely agrees with their primary funders, and people who've heard me say this on the air, I apologize for saying it again, but so that side goes for touchdowns. The other side has some alleged principles, some historical perspective that disagrees with its primary funders, and so it goes for the 20-yard line. And when you have one side going for touchdowns and one side going for the 20-yard line, basically the team going for the 20-yard line never gets big victories, never does the policy that's actually needed to make the difference, and is viewed by the public as weak and somehow ineffective. Either of you want to chime in on that one?
Well, that's certainly true. I mean, when you write about the Democrats, it's always this sort of, one disappointment after another. But I'm always, astonished by, if we flip this thing around and look at the way and this is what Pity the Billionaire is about, look at the way that the conservative movement was able to bounce back after this sort of staggering historical defeat in 2008, after you had all the scandals of the Bush years and then sort of crowned by this, financial collapse, which was as direct a sort of judgment on a political ideology as I've seen in my lifetime or since the collapse of the Soviet Union anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And they bounced back within a year. They were back and had moved further to the right. Remember, they purged all those moderates, got rid of those guys, moved themselves way off to the right edge, and then won this sort of smashing victory in 2010 all over the country. That is an amazing story.
And I'm going to ask you to chime in a second, Edgar, but to me, that moment a year into Obama's term, which is a year before that 2010 election, when you say he could have done this, but he didn't because he was afraid to offend his funders, I assume even then you couldn't have predicted that his failure to do so, the breach that he created by his failure to do so, by his failure to tell the real story to the people of what had happened and what needed to be done, left an opening that would be filled so ably by the right, and within 2 years they basically win win Congress back, even though what they're fighting against is basically their own doing.
Well, I think part of that too is the reaction against government and the ways in which government began to be perceived as simply a deliverer of services. And I think part of what has happened is that there's been a growing reaction to what I call the outsourcing, not just the outsourcing of jobs, what I'm going to call the outsourcing of citizenship responsibilities and the outsourcing, frankly, of our own humanity and our own responsibilities as a human being to the both to the nonprofit world and to the world of human service deliverers. And so if people are neutralized, the voice that he could have commanded are all being defined as takers and as recipients and not as participants. And it's the failure to enlist them that I think is the opening now that we have to begin to say, how do we stop the outsourcing of those responsibilities?
Let me tell people, I'm Terrence McNally. The voices you hear are Thomas Frank, and the last one was Edgar Kahn. We're talking about where we are as a nation, and so far a lot of it is, has been the thread between economics and politics, because that is so much who we are. Tom Frank is the author of several books, including What's the Matter with Kansas? His latest is Pity the Billionaire, and you can learn more about him at tcfrank.com. Edgar Kahn has been a wonderful social justice entrepreneur for years, co-founding Legal Services and Time Dollars. You can learn more at timebanks.org. Since you've brought up that notion, Tom, we will come back to you to get a little more of the detail of what you learned in the research that you did, because Pity the Billionaire definitely is a book based on research of sort of unraveling this mystery of how could you possibly pull that off, what the right has pulled off.
Yeah.
But Edgar, you've mentioned twice this notion of reviving the services that government provides by changing the definition, the perception, and so on, and getting away from this sense of outsourcing. Tell us a little bit more, with a historical perspective, of what you mean by that.
Well, from the beginning, I saw when I launched Legal Services that it wasn't what lawyers could do, but it was what lawyers could unleash in terms of the citizenry itself. And what I'm excited about now is I'm going back into the trenches now, Terrence, and I'm going out into the community, and I'm saying to the community, I want you to pay it forward in response for the legal services being delivered by my law school. In legal aid in Oregon, for the first time, an office in Oregon is asking, the legal aid office is asking its clients to pay it forward by joining a time bank. I think if we don't use the delivery of services to unleash the capacity in community, we define people's only assets as their need for services, and that paralyzes them, and that reinforces the whole negative view of government as creating dependencies rather than as dealing with legitimate and real needs, but needs that don't begin to define the whole human being. What I see now is a chance, and I see consistently happening around the country, a kind of pay-it-forward dynamic that says it's not enough to receive, it's not that we have to give up dealing with legitimate needs, but we have to ask everybody to find new ways to chip in, to rebuild community, to strengthen schools, to deal with homelessness, to deal with the needs of the elderly, and there's no way in which any amount of government services can take care of all the needs of the elderly, all the needs of that are now being created by gangs, by school dropouts, by the absence of affordable child care. And if we don't begin to find new ways to do that, and this is why, for me, this is about money and about what money does, because if money is the only value we have, then we're hooked into, frankly, what the right wing knows how to do. Our major industry now is generating digits in cyberspace. I don't consider that to be significant production of goods and services, and I think we've got ample ability to produce, but that we don't have a distributive system that enables people by contributing to the work of civic engagement and the work of raising children and the work of making democracy work. We don't have a distributive system that enables people to eat and have a roof over their heads.
And what would be that system, Edgar?
Well, I think we need another medium of exchange. You look at education. There was education long before we had a medium of exchange called grades, academic credits, and degrees. But you see what a medium of exchange does to create institutions of learning and higher learning. We don't have a medium of exchange, and that's what I created with time banking, a medium of exchange that rewards citizenship and enables people by helping to build citizenship to eat, to take care of each other, and to help. And now I see it blossoming in 34 countries, and I see people rediscovering the need for community.
Okay,
for the absence of a medium of exchange that values caring and decency and common humanity has been a critical lack. And now we know there's vast capacity in community, there's vast unmet needs, money isn't there to put the two together, and so I think we needed, and now it's going to open source time banking, is we need a medium of exchange that enables us by helping each other to survive and to get the kind of budget relief we need by helping each other.
Okay, for those people who were, oh, but let me say, by the way, we're right at the halfway point. I'm Terrence McNally. The show is Free Forum. And I'm speaking with Thomas Frank and Edgar Kahn, both about their individual work. With Edgar, it's his going back into the trenches in a way to link one of his innovations, which was legal services, to another one of his innovations, which is time banking and time dollars. Tom Frank's newest book, Pity the Billionaire, does a job of analyzing how the right could possibly be the winners when they were the destroyers. So those are the two works we're talking about. And then we're talking about that in a general sort of larger question of where do we stand as we head into 2012. Hello, this is Terrence McNally. You're listening to my 2012 conversation with serial social justice entrepreneur Edgar Kahn and influential author and social critic Thomas Frank, most famous for What's the Matter with Kansas. Edgar, for those people who have no idea what time banking or time dollars is, please explain.
It uses a currency that where 1 hour gives you one credit in the bank that you can, and you earn those hours by helping others or by civic participation or by engaging in some kind of a community project that makes a difference. You can spend that to get anything from child care to tutoring to elder care. And the IRS has ruled that this is basically a tax exempt system, so that we use it to run programs of tutoring and of elder care. It's being used in Vermont to provide a form of long-term elder care. Mayor Bloomberg has launched it in New York City to provide the informal non-medical care for the elderly. In Washington, D.C., we use it to pay the kids on a youth court who sit as jurors and who handle 70% of nonviolent crime by teenagers. And what we see is that what we need to rebuild is the civic economy. I think this is a country that's proud of its traditions of civic engagement. We stand for certain basic values, and that we lose sight of that when it becomes all about money and all about who can make money and all about how much money you can make. I think we've been sucked into a vortex without a set of alternatives. But I think this nation really has at its heart decency, caring, and justice.
Now, how has the fact that Time Dollars came out in 1992. You've been doing this for a while. How did the crash and the rampaging unemployment, which meant people who had valuable talents and services now had no job and perhaps had no money, how has that impacted time dollars and time banking?
Well, it means that each year it's multiplied by a factor of two or four or more, and it means that we've had the necessity to move our time banking to Drupal to open source so that it could begin to spread around the country. You've got 14 time banks just in the Los Angeles area alone. It's in Sobrante Park in Oakland. It's being used to by the public health department to reduce violence there. And so we're seeing it used by people, on the one hand, for budget relief, for simple things like home repair and child care and haircuts and elder care. But we're also seeing it used to build bridges back to jobs because people need to practice interview skills. They need babysitting while they go for the jobs. They need transportation and childcare. So it's, and then now increasingly it's being used by government agencies and by the nonprofit world to deal with the cutbacks that we see, you know, in human service programs.
So it's basically people who have a skill, have a talent, have a willingness to do something, and they're frozen out, whether at this moment or for most, you know, for a period of time, out of the ability to be paid for this. They can offer that in exchange for other skills, talents, and services that others can provide. And so people can meet each other's needs without the exchange of funds.
Yeah, but it's also, it's not just marketable skills. If you can listen, you have a skill. If you can talk to somebody who's isolated and alone and depressed, you have a skill. We have a five-year-old who went up to a former gang leader who said, we have trash cans here and we use them, because he had thrown a candy wrapper on the ground. She was earning time credits to get dancing lessons. So in turn, it redefines everybody as part of that workforce. People who are bedridden are part of the quality control system and part of a mutual support system. It's about re-knitting community in a world where we live on top of each other, but we live as strangers.
Very good. That's Edgar Kahn. We're talking about time dollars and time banking, and you can learn more at timebanks, one word, .org. Tom Frank, if this whole knowledge, this whole area that Edgar's talking about is fairly new to you, how does that sort of thing sit inside of the larger trends and issues you've been thinking about and following?
Well, it is new to me. I don't know. I've never heard about this system before. It sounds like a good idea, though. The only precedent I know of for it, in this country anyways, would be during the Depression, when you had a lot of people that were doing, you know, barter. In the early years of the Depression, money was very scarce. There was sort of tremendous deflation. And, people were issuing scrip and stuff like that, but there were also barter economies that popped up all over the country. And one of the interesting things about that is that the 30s, when you had these barter economies, it was a time of real sort of community solidarity. Lots of different historians and people who were around at the time have commented on this. This is sort of a famous angle of this is one of the things that was sort of good about the 1930s. You know, when the economy just fell completely apart, people came together in all sorts of informal ways and helped one another out. And you had things like one of the movements that I write about in Pity the Billionaire, which, you know, has this sort of long-running comparison of our present day to the 1930s. One of the movements that I focus on was called the Farm Holiday Association in Iowa. And what they would do, this is not exactly barter or time banking, they would keep bankers from foreclosing on their neighbors in Iowa. They would prevent this from happening. And in Nebraska, too, it happened all over the Midwest. And the reason that's so fascinating to me is because this sort of community spirit that you saw in the 1930s expressed itself in these populist movements back then, okay, like the Iowa farmers. Today, you have a populist movement again that's risen up in response to a sort of severe economic downturn, but they have exactly the opposite sensibility, okay? They hate their neighbors. If you go look at the literature of the Tea Party movement, or the literature of the sort of resurgent right, whenever they talk about the financial crisis and the bailouts, they talk about how people who in their estimation bought houses that were too large for them, those people need to be foreclosed upon. They need to lose those houses. Those people need to go down. I went to the very first Tea Party rally back in February of 2009, and I'll never forget this sign that I saw there. It said, "Your mortgage is not my problem."
Mm-hmm.
And it was exactly the opposite of the spirit that Edgar is talking about. And it came about, this is what just blew my mind, it came about as a result of the same kind of downturn as you saw in the early 1930s.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things I'm reminded of is Rebecca Solnit's book, Paradise in oh, I'm going to get the title slightly wrong unless one of you can help me. Paradise in a Place Called Hell, I believe is what it is. But she, having experienced the community coming together after Katrina, when the press and the media talked about looting and so on, she said no. In fact, what was happening down there was a community coming together, not a community breaking apart. And she then went and researched six natural disasters, the 06 San Francisco earthquake, etc., and found that this is what happens, that in the face of disaster, people come together. They do not turn against each other, which means that what's happening with the Tea Party and with people turning against each other in misfortune rather than with each other is not what happens all the time,
isn't it? It's amazing.
Yeah,
and that it would be so popular. You know, it's sweeping the country. This kind of bitterness and this resentment of your neighbors. And by the way, it was there from the very beginning. You think of Rick Santelli's famous, the rant that launched the movement.
Yeah,
the CNBC thing.
Mm-hmm.
And in it, he was talking about the neighbor who bought more house than they deserved.
Yeah, he didn't talk about the banks who got people to sign loans they couldn't afford.
That's right. No, predatory lending. No, he didn't talk about that. No.
No.
Of course not. I mean, I say of course not. That's why? You know, it's just we are living in it's like a version of 1929, 1932, where every force is going in reverse.
Yeah, it's Alice in Wonderland. It's a funhouse mirror.
Exactly right, and that's why my title, Pity the Billionaire.
Yeah,
because they're the real ones. They're the real casualties. You know, things are so hard for them this time around. You know, it's sarcasm. You see?
Of course, of course. Now let me ask both of you, and I'll start with you, Tom, and then Edgar. What about the Occupy movement and the 99% movement? I will tell you just a pleasant moment for me this week was I gave some money to Code Pink over the end of the year, and they sent me some stickers, and the stickers were I heart the 99%, right?
Yeah,
and I just put one on my stepson's desk while he was out.
My own opinion is that protest was very powerful.
Well, wait. I was just going to say, I put it on my stepson's desk. The next time I walked into his room, he had stuck it on his computer, on the outside of his computer, which means it's a badge he's wearing constantly, because if there's any kids have with them at all times, it's their computer or their phone. So I just say that was a little moment for me. But yes, your reflection on Occupy, and then yours as well, Edgar.
Okay, well, this is Tom Frank here. I'm obviously pretty heartened by it. I think it's a really good sign. And I am the 99% online protest. I read that and I thought that just blew me away. It was the greatest thing in the world. I mean, it really was eloquent and powerful. Now, I don't know whether camping out in public squares is the way to do a protest movement, or what that's going to achieve. But we're at the very beginning of this, okay? So we have to wait and see. But I would say this: at this point, I also spent some time in Wisconsin with the people who were protesting Governor Walker,
mm-hmm.
in Wisconsin, and it was a very similar kind of protest. And I got very close to that one, and I can tell you about that it is, it's more just a scream of desperation and outrage. I mean, these are people who are seeing their way of life be threatened, okay? And their backs are to the wall. And while I'm glad that they're finally fighting back, it is really late in the game,
mm-hmm.
really late in the game.
Well, but you actually said two things, Tom. It is very late in the game, and it is very early in the movement. Both are true.
That's right. So, we have a long way to go.
Yeah. Now, by the way,
hopefully we can get this thing turned around. I mean, I'd love to see that happen.
David DeGraw, who was one of the who may have written the We Are the 99%, he was certainly one of the first people to coin that term and one of the first people to show up at Zuccotti Park and help organize those demonstrations. I had him on December 4th, and he basically when people ask me, well, what happened to the Occupy movement, since they've been evicted? And I say it's basically, it's the winter and they're on hiatus. And that what's happening right now, for people who don't know this, is it's planning time. And that in the spring, I think, is when, in the spring of 2012, I think, is when we will see what this movement's next steps are. I don't expect much between now and then, but in the spring, in a few months, I think that will be the time to measure, you know, what are the actions that will represent we are the 99% besides the initial actions of occupying a public space, and we will see how the public responds. One thing that I have seen is that in terms of public opinion, that I think it might be Pew, it might be someone else, did some things recently, and at this moment, more people find themselves in sympathy when you ask people with the 99% movement and the Occupy movement than with the Tea Party movement, and both of them are vastly more popular than the government.
That's funny. I mean, that's certainly a step in the right direction.
Yeah,
that's good. That's good to hear.
I think it's Edgar. More than a step in the right direction. The question is, what are the next steps? I've done teach-ins both at Occupy Washington and Occupy Wall Street, and I've met with them. And what you see is two things. One, you see enormous chaos and confusion and things that are easy to take cheap shots at. But also you see in every forum, whether it's ministers and rabbis who can now talk about poverty, and whether it's columnists who can talk about what Wall Street in fact did, whether it's politicians who now find it safe to talk about what were before taboo subjects, and whether it's academicians who are prepared to look at economics the way and political institutions the way they're really operating, I think you're beginning to see an awakening to the depth which the political system has been bought, and the depths to which we've in fact walked away from our core values. And my hope is that as this semester moves along, that you'll see that begin to take root in a different kind of political climate around civic engagement, and you'll begin to see the whole nonprofit world understanding that if we don't begin to return to rebuilding community in a different kind of way, that we don't have the political system, and the democratic system itself is lost to the folks who can buy the Congress, the political system.
Absolutely. That's the voice of Edgar Kahn. My other guest today is Thomas Frank. I'm Terrence McNally. This is Free Forum on KPFK 90.7 FM, 98.7 FM. You can learn more about Tom's work at tcfrank.com and more about Edgar's work at timebanks.org. One of the things that it seemed to me when we spoke off air, Edgar, you said, I think, was that early age of activist government, the war on poverty, the civil rights movement, and so on, that there were some mistakes made in the fact that there wasn't a pay it forward. There wasn't there was a piece missing. Can you talk a bit about that? That you think led to some of the both the problems and the negative perceptions?
Well, we focused on needs and problems, and one can understand that, but that meant that we created, and I was part of creating, that whole wave of entitlements which are now in disrepute. But in doing so, that was a step beyond charity, but what we failed to understand was that we defined the person by their problem. Their problem is less than 5% of them. The other 95% we didn't unleash, but we made their only assets their problems, and if those are your only assets, you grow your assets, and then people say, well, what do those programs do? But what they did was they made having a problem the way in which you got help. What I see as the new wave that Eleanor Ostrom articulated and that we're articulating here at Time Banks is something called co-production, which transforms the recipient of service into a worker and co-producer of the outcome. And I think that's what I'm trying to do with legal services, but we see it with health services. Visiting nurses enroll 3,000 of people who are patients as co-producers of health and mutual support. And we're seeing that in Oakland, where the people who were, quote, the problem are now the peacemakers and the peace givers. And so I'm seeing that the process of giving help, if we begin to wake up to the possibility that every helping transaction can turn the recipient into a co-worker and co-producer and partner, we can begin to build, I think, the community solidarity that will lead to the kind of political climate that supports, I think, enlightened government, but also government that doesn't just reward needs, but that unleashes the capacity of citizens to build.
That's exciting. Tom, I would think that when you were back doing research on the phenomenon in Pity the Billionaire, what you found was, as I see it, is that the right has come up with this word elites.
Yes.
And this word,
they're referring to you and me, Terrence.
I know, and Edgar. They are. And basically, when you can define the enemy as elites, and then what you define is people somehow other than you are those victims that the elites cater to, that it seems to me what Edgar's saying about that there was an error made, and I think an awful lot of errors that the U.S. made were errors. They were errors of blindness, but they were errors sort of indulgence and luxury. That when in that period when it looked like we had so much money and we had so much power and so on, that we didn't look at the how things fit together. We just felt, okay, some people are victims, it's time we help them, rather than seeing, as you defined it, Edgar, that people who were victims were not merely victims. They were. They had the opportunity. There was the opportunity that they had an enormous amount to give, and that when you begin to shift those definitions of who's an elite and who's a victim by redefining all of that, that maybe that's the long and difficult work we've all got to do.
Yeah, but we're losing that battle, Terrence.
Let's hear Tom first, and then you, Edgar. Tom.
Yeah, I was going to say we're losing that battle. Like I said, the conservative movement has succeeded by sort of replicating a hard time social protest. Although if you dig deep enough, you discover you don't have to dig very deep at all, but you quickly discover that the actual politics and attitudes that they're promoting are the opposite of what you see in actual real populist movements, but they talk a real good game. And I'm just reminded of one of the sort of big conservative fads of the year 2010, this sort of fad idea that they had. They grabbed hold of the phrase ruling class. There was a famous magazine article, I think it was in National Review, that came out. It was called The Ruling Class, and it was made into a book almost immediately. And the right just, they loved this. And by the election day 2010, I remember one of the conservative activists whose work I follow regularly. It's Richard Viguerie up mm-hmm. in Northern Virginia, and he had his election night watch party with something. It was called like "Out with the Ruling Class." I mean, it was full on class war. And if you go back and read this article that I'm referring to in this book, it's actually very eloquent stuff. It reads like a kind of, you know, Karl Marx of the right, you know, going into battle against this horrible ruling class that's made up of these sort of Ivy League snobs and these people whose businesses are you know, subsidized by government, you know, and it's this grand theory of, I mean, it's really quite an amazing thing. It's this sort of universal totalizing theory of class in America that has absolutely nothing to do with the actual conditions of class in America. But it's nevertheless, they've got the language, they've got the anger, you know, it looks for everything in the world like a real, legitimate, hard times protest movement, and they have signed people up by the millions. It is an amazing thing.
Okay, we've got about 4 minutes left. Let me give you each 2 minutes, and I'll start with Edgar and then Tom. Looking at the year ahead, your hopes, fears, and the election can fit in there or not.
Well, picking up where Tom left off, Bill Moyers said years ago that the rich had declared class war on the poor and they were winning. And what they did was they used the political system, in effect, to consolidate those gains. I think what we've left out of this picture, frankly, is that the class war that you're describing is a war that now is a war on race and in the 60s we were concerned with victims because we were living with the racism and segregation. I think we're now seeing a similar kind of use of privilege and wealth to perpetuate that racism. But I think that as the ethnic composition of this country changes, that we're going to see, if we begin to enlist the people whom we've defined as having problems as allies and as a resource, we have a combination of the media, the nonprofit world, the so-called elite. If we're smart in saying we need each other and we need them as badly as they need anything we can do, we can unleash forces that can't be stopped to rebuild the kind of world that we all can live in together and that we can put behind us a legacy of racism and the kind of xenophobia that you see being stirred up against Hispanics.
And before I turn to you, Tom, let me just say one thing that I hear in what you're saying, Edgar, and that is one of those things that gives me hope. I mean, I think it even comes through in my tone, in the way I speak, that I've got some sort of optimistic streak. But I do think that the millennials, that the young people are that the right's triumph has not necessarily enrolled the young, and that the right's triumph, as far as I can see it, and you may in your last statement tell me I'm wrong, but is elders holding on, and is elders grasping for something, but that I do think that the long term play here of young people, it seems to me, do look at these things differently, and whether it comes to racism, whether it comes to who's an elite, and all of these things, I do sense that everything my interactions with them, and everything I read about them says that actually, you know, the next generation is not going to buy into this, and I don't know what it's going to look like, but it's going to look different. Tom, your look at the year ahead.
I hope you guys are right about all that, but you know me, I'm a sort of professional pessimist. And my feeling is that, I mean, I have no idea who's going to win the election this fall, whether it's going to be President Obama or whether it's going to be Mitt Romney. But my fear is that, I mean, the Republican Party, which is after all one of the two players in a duopoly, you know, they've got half of the system no matter what. They're going to get in sooner or later. And the thing is that they have been moving to the right for 40 years. They're still moving to the right. And in fact, they learned in 2010 that moving to the right is, very perversely, they learned, I think, that that's the way to win. And I think that if and when they win this fall or in, the next time around or something like that, you are going to see the kind of, wrecking and obstructionism and sabotage and, not just deregulation, but defunding of, all of these, the mechanisms of the state on a scale that we've never seen before, because they are so much more committed to this philosophy today than they were, 8 years ago. They're much more deeply committed to it now. And so that's my concern.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Tom Frank's new book is Pity the Billionaire. His website is tcfrank.com. Edgar Kahn's work you can learn more about at timebanks.org. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others anytime during the week by linking to the podcast. You can sign up to have it delivered to you weekly. You can do both of those things at iTunes or at my site, terrencemcnally.net. terrencemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They are the same site. You can also sign up there or by emailing me, get an email each week that tells you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and some background on the issues. And my email is temcnally, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y, at mac.com. This program will be archived for the next 90 days at kpfk.org. You check audio archives and scroll down by date and time. Thanks to G, my engineer, Stan Mizrahi and Mark Spaxwell in production, Matt Perez in traffic, and to you, my listeners. I look forward to being with you again next week. My guests will be, in the first half, Stephen Greenblatt, author of the 2011 National Book Award winner, The Swerve, How the World Became Modern, and in the second half, John Rotz, about a new organization called Global Alliance for Transformational Media, trying to use media to move us forward. Finally, thank you to Thomas Frank and Edgar Kahn. Keep up the good work.